want a little audience participation as we start this morning. What do you see? A pen? Okay. Anything else? Stylus. Anything else? Piece of plastic? You see me? Needle for sewing? My hand behind my back? Okay. A lot of you made assumptions about what you saw. You made the assumption that this was a pen or some other objects, but you know, this could have been a tire pressure gauge because they're about the same size, about the same color. You also made another assumption. You made the assumption that I wanted you to identify this. I just said, what do you see? You know, I was about 18 and I was working for a local retailer here in Ventura, and I was working in the warehouse, and one day he had us do inventory. There were about three of us, and he gave each of us a section, and at that time he gave us a certain amount of time to inventory that section and then to come back and tell him what we'd found. And we came back, and the other two guys gave their report, and I gave my report. And I said about a certain particular item that we had in stock that there were about this many. And he looked at me, and he said, about? And I said, well, yeah, I assume there were that many. He says, do you know what the word assume means? Yeah, you know what it means, don't you? We make assumptions about things, don't we? Oftentimes based on what we have seen before or what we think. But they aren't always true, are they? They're just assumptions. Our answers also have a lot to do, your answers this morning, have a lot to do with where your focus is. That's the way we are. Isn't it interesting that I could hold up this ballpoint pen and you would all focus pretty much on that? A few of you focused on me. But how small this pen is and how small I am in regards to this whole room and all the people and all of the chairs and everything else that's in this room. But you chose to focus right here. We do that, don't we? We often focus very narrowly on things rather than stepping back and seeing a larger picture. Our focus shapes our vision. Our assumptions and our focus shape our vision. There's a third thing that comes into play too. Whenever we're asked what we see, we have to accept the fact that there are limits to our answers because of what we're able to see. You know, if you and I had telescopic vision and I held up that pen and you were looking at more than just that object, you might be able to see the atoms in the air that go to make up what exists. Or you might be able to see in a very clear fashion the fabric that goes to make up this screen or other things that are in this room. But we don't have that. There are limits to our vision. God has limited what we have the ability to see as human beings. Can you imagine the eye strain if we had telescopic vision or microscopic vision? There are things that we have not seen that either exist today or that have existed, but we've never seen them. There are places that we have never seen. There are things that are too small for us to see, even with the best of microscopes. There are things too far away to see, even with the best of telescopes. There are things that have not yet been found, and so no one has seen them. Our vision of life, our worldview or our philosophy of life is based on what we've seen, on what we've experienced, or what we believe is true. The Bible offers only two visions of life or worldviews. And the scripture reading this morning from 1 John chapter 4 and verses 1 through 6 expresses those two worldviews, those two visions of life, that of the world and that of God. So, how do you see life? Is this life all there is? Is it meaningless because of that? Or do you see more than this life? If so, do you see that the way we live gives meaning to this life? We've been looking in Ecclesiastes the last 4 weeks, and we've been looking at how the writer wrestles with the meaning of life, and how he constantly comes back to this phrase, everything is meaningless. Life is meaningless. But this author of Ecclesiastes was limited to this world, and so he could not see beyond physical death. His questions about this and how they led him to see no meaning in life come up repeatedly. For example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and in verses 18 through 22, he remarks, I also thought, as for men, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Notice this is what his vision is. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all remain, all return. Who knows if the spirit of man rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down to the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better for man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? He goes on in chapter 6 and verse 12 to say, for who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? In chapter 7 verse 14 he says, when times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider, God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, man cannot discover anything about his future. In chapter 8, verses 7 through 8, he says, since no man knows the future, who can tell him what is to come? Since no man has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the day of his death. And then in chapter 9, and in verses 1 through 6, he says, so I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. But no man knows whether love or hate awaits him. All share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good man, so with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there's madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, But the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Now, this author acknowledges God's presence and God's power, but he does not have hope in God. His conclusions comes only from what he sees, and it shapes his vision of life. It shapes life's meaningless nature as he sees it, and it shapes the lack of any future hope as he sees it. In chapter 7, verses 23 through 25 and verse 29, he says, I am determined to be wise. Isn't that what he started with early on in this short letter? I am determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. He's already said he had more wisdom than anyone else about him. And yet now he says this wisdom that he sought for was beyond him. Whatever wisdom may be, it is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate, and to search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. In chapter 8, verses 16 to 17, he concludes, when I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe man's labor on earth, his eyes not seeing sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. I wonder if he really had. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Well, we can agree with that to some extent, can't we? If not fully. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. As he observed the nature of life, this author developed a dark vision of life on earth. Many people have shared that vision. Many people share it today in many places around our globe. They're embittered about life's injustices, and they see no purpose or meaning in life. Now, in all fairness, even those of us who are Christians struggle with that, don't we? Don't we have our moments when we're listening to the nightly news that we hear about something that's happened somewhere, whether in this country or another, and we wonder, why does God allow that to happen? Or we wonder, what's the purpose of that? Or we wonder, how do those people ever have any sense of meaning in life? Because it seems like these things that are happening to them now happen over and over and over, generation after generation. What's it all about? And when people who are anti-God raise these questions, maybe at work or in some other setting where we're present, we find ourselves struggling to give an answer that both we believe and that has any satisfying effect. Isn't that true? And ultimately, don't we struggle with it within? We say, I know God's in charge, and I know God is love, and I know God has a plan and a purpose, and I know that good things are going to eventually happen. I believe that. But these things really are difficult for me to understand. I can understand why people turn away from God. I can understand why people see no purpose or meaning in life. And so we find ourselves able to identify, don't we, with people who are embittered because of life's injustices and who see no purpose or meaning in life. They question what, if anything, happens after death. Their vision of God is that if he exists, he has very little compassion toward human beings. Their discouragements obsess and eventually blind them to God's love at work in this life. Jesus made an observation that is more than an observation. It's a statement of fact. It's found in Matthew chapter 5, and Jesus said, God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike. God is at work even when we don't think of it as being God, but it all has to do with what we assume, what we focus on, and what we believe. The author of Ecclesiastes wrote, there is something else meaningless that occurs on earth. Righteous men who get what the wicked deserve, and wicked men who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of the life God has given him under the sun. And he continues this in chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes and verses 7 through 12 when he says, go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you're going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. If, like this author, this is all you see, then life is meaningless, life is purposeless, and life is without hope. If you see God providing people with barely enough to make this life tolerable, then God is meaningless. But there's much more to this life because there is much more to God. There's a vision that sees God's loving faithfulness to humanity. There's a vision with reason to believe God's promises. There is a vision of faith in God. In Romans chapter 18 through 20, the writer personally challenges us when he says this: the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Did you catch that last piece there? For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen. So what is it that causes some of us to assume certain things about God or the absence of God? What is it that causes some of us to focus on the dark things of this earth, of this life, and not on God and the blessings that he brings every moment? What is there that causes some of us to have such a hard time believing in things of God that are not clearly seen because we don't look at what is clearly seen? As chapter 1 of Romans continues, it impresses that living in denial of God's nature and his loving care brings permanent removal from God's care. God sees and knows immeasurably more than humans can. So the writer of Proverbs says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones." The author of Ecclesiastes admits to the limitations of his great wisdom as a human being. And he also admits to the limitations of wisdom to that of any other so-called wise person. When we determine as human beings what life is about from our limited vision, we come to false conclusions. That's the point in 1 Corinthians in chapter 1 and in verses 20 through 29. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, non-Jews. But to those whom God has called, to those we might say who can see beyond the agony, the bitterness of this life, who can see God in action, to those whom he has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. Where our vision of wisdom leads us is identified in James chapter 3 and verses 13 through 18. There James says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raised a harvest of righteousness." This is why 1 John chapter 2 and verses 15 through 17 urges us, "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever." There's the answer to the question that haunted Ecclesiastes' author. The man who does the will of God lives forever. There is meaning and hope in this life if we do God's will. There is eternal spiritual life after this life if we do God's will. Our lives have purpose and value and meaning as we do God's will. We are being trained and tested and tempered in preparation for unending life with God. Praise God for that. Praise God for giving us meaning and value and purpose and joy in this life, despite all the dark things in this life. If we believe this life is the only life, then we will live life our way. We won't be concerned about being accountable to anyone, including God. But if we believe this life is only our preparation for eternal spiritual life, then we will live God's way. We'll concern ourselves with being accountable to God. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8 cautions, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ." That's a challenge for every Christian. But I would suggest to you that it's more than just to Christians. That's a challenge for every person on the face of this earth. Because it is so easy, it is so normal for us to get caught up, to become captivated, if you will, by these hollow and deceptive philosophies that depend on human tradition and the basic principles of this life. Isn't that what is reimposed and reemphasized to us literally every waking hour? If our vision is limited to only what we see in this life, then the writer of Ecclesiastes is right. Life is meaningless and hopeless. But if we see God's blessings in this life, and if we see God offering us life beyond this life, then this life is both meaningful and hopeful. And that's what God constantly offers us from the beginning of time, is meaning, value, and hope. God calls you and me to see Him and His loving work eternally at work. He calls us to embrace Him, to have unending life with Him. He calls you to that right now. If you're ready to give your life to Him, if you're ready to embrace Him, if you're ready to believe that there is a life that God gives us now to prepare us for life eternal, then this is the moment to make that change of life, that change of meaning, that change of purpose, that change of value, and to come to joy as you come to Jesus. If we can aid you in any way, we urge you to come forward right now as we stand and sing.